From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen says she's talking with border state governors today about the president's plan to deploy National Guard troops to the border with Mexico. It is not clear how many will be deployed, but on Fox News today, Nielsen was asked if troops from other states would be sent to California if Governor Jerry Brown doesn't agree to deploy the California Guard.
He has supported such use of the border or use in support of the Border Patrol in the past. As you know, we've done this at least twice in the last 10 decades. So I'd like to have further conversations with him before I jump ahead of him and how he would like to secure his border.
Sure.
Joining us now from Arizona is Michelle Marisco, senior editor at KJZZ's Fronteras Desk. And Michelle, what's the reaction there? I understand Arizona Governor Doug Ducey is supporting the deployment.
Governor Doug Ducey has been supporting it. He's one of three border governors who so far have signed on. Here in Arizona, I can tell you that some of the county sheriffs along the border are looking forward to what they call a bolstering of a U.S. Presence on the border. Others are questioning what they're going to be doing, and that has a brief history. The last two times that the military, the National Guard, was called down to the border, one of the biggest criticisms was that nobody was quite sure what their role was going to be. So, you know, we got a lot of National Guardsmen back then in 2010, for example, who were, quote unquote, staring at a fence throughout most of the day.
And Michelle, that was at a time when the conditions along the border were very different, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, that was at a time when, and I know that you covered this yourself, you remember the murder of Arizona border rancher Robert Krentz in 2010, who presumably was killed by a Mexican drug smuggler, but nobody ever solved that case.
Mm-hmm. You know, back in 2016, I was along the border, and ranchers then at the time told me that, you know, they had drug smugglers who were crossing over their land, tearing down their fences. The threat of intimidation always seemed to be a big part of their life. And they said that, you know, even more than an improved border wall down there, they welcomed having more support for Border Patrol agents. Do you get the sense among civilians that there's support for this?
There is a support for Border Patrol. There is definitely a support for technology. You remember even as recently as a year ago, Customs and Border Protection was implementing those radio and video surveillance towers along the border.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not getting that there's an overwhelming sense from people down here that want a military presence, a National Guard presence at the border. Yes, there's definitely ranchers who say that there's a need for it. But as far as overwhelming, I'm thinking of areas like Nogales, Douglas, Arizona. I'm just not seeing it.
Well, as you know, there's also been a longstanding debate in general along the border about militarization. People saying that over the years, as more Border Patrol agents have come in, it has changed the fabric of communities. Are people talking about that today?
You know, one of the interesting dynamics of this mission, just like the previous two missions, is that these National Guard soldiers are not going to be armed.
Mm.
So there's always been this fear, this concern that there would be an increase of border militarization. And there has been an increase of federal presence, absolutely. But the National Guard is not part of that.
Numbers out yesterday from the federal government show that arrests have spiked since the beginning of the year, despite being way down, historically speaking, over the long term. Is that something that you've noticed, more people starting to cross?
Well, and it's always a big question in March. You know, January, February, December, it's really cold. And there's not a whole lot of seasonal work in the United States at that point. So March and April are traditionally the highest months of the year where undocumented immigration happens into the U.S. This has been going back 40, 50 years. Right now, the numbers compared to March of last year, and I think this is a really important point. So when you look at the numbers from this past March to last year's March, yes, they're up phenomenally. However, when you look at them from March of 2016, they're right in line with 2016, 2015, and 2014.
Mm.
So it's curious to me that Homeland Security would pick this one data point, March of 2018, to say, yes, there's definitely an emergency, a quote-unquote crisis at the border.
What about violence? Have you seen more of that?
you know, the violence that, that we see on the border generally stays in Mexico. I mean, you know, there's always been a worry about spillover, a crossover effect, a cross-border killings, and we just haven't seen that on the United States side, obviously. You know, when you look at Reynosa, Nuevo Laredo, some of these cities south of Texas, yes, absolutely, violence is as prevalent as ever in some of those cities. Now, it's been that way since at least 2004, when you had Zeta drug cartel and Sinaloa cartel gunmen shooting rockets and grenades at each other. So this isn't a new situation for that part of Texas either.
That's Michel Morisco. He's a senior editor at KJZZ's Fronteras desk based out of Tucson. Michel, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Peter.
Our next story had its beginnings in Colorado in 2014. Doctors there noticed a cluster of mysterious cases, children coming in with weak or paralyzed limbs. Then reports came in from across the country of kids complaining of the same symptoms. Doctors and researchers were mystified. Now, nearly 4 years later, there may be an answer. From member station KUNC in Greeley, Colorado, Rayellen Bichelle reports.
It was the fall of 2014 when Sarah Pilarowski noticed her daughter Lydia acting strange. The six-year-old was just getting better after a long fever, and she was finally getting to play the piano again.
I watched as she took her right hand and she put it on top of her left hand to make her left hand play some piano keys. And I was like, well, that's really strange. And I was like, Lydia, why are you doing that? And she's like, well, Mom, my hand isn't working right.
A few days later, Pilarowski noticed that her daughter couldn't eat an ear of corn. It kept falling out of her hands.
And then I started to panic because I realized that something was really wrong.
The Pilarowskis took Lydia to the hospital, where doctors took an MRI and tested her nerves. The word polio came up.
And it's a lot to wrap your brain around to be thinking that your child is essentially experiencing polio.
But was it polio? Doctors around the region were sending children with similar symptoms to the same Colorado hospital. A few even needed machines to help them breathe.
Right now, state health officials are investigating a rare type of illness known as AFM.
It's scary because it's random, fast, and virulent, and more children have now been stricken.
Suddenly, she was paralyzed. A polio-like disease, acute flaccid myelitis, had struck.
But Dr. Kevin Messikar is a pediatric infectious disease specialist at Children's Hospital Colorado. He says that summer was mayhem.
Yeah, 2014 was a really unusual year.
So far, they found no connection in these cases.
Wheezing children flooded the hospital. Some had paralyzed faces or limbs. And the MRI images of the kids' spines
really didn't look like anything we had seen before.
They showed a stripe of inflammation all down their spinal cords, like West Nile virus or poliovirus. But neither of those viruses was the culprit. They looked for other viruses in the kids' spinal fluid. Again, nothing. So they took swabs of the kids' throats and noses. Bingo.
We were finding this newly circulating virus, enterovirus D68.
Enterovirus D68. But it still didn't make any sense. How can a virus that lives in a person's nose and throat get all the way into their spinal cord to cause nerve damage? And if it did do that, why wasn't it in the patient's spinal fluid anymore?
That was one of the mysteries. How does a respiratory virus lead to paralysis?
The next summer, there were just a few cases here and there. But then, another big cluster.
In 2016, that was really the clincher when we saw the virus circulating again from July to October and also saw these cases reappear.
About 150 more people, mostly kids, came in with partial paralysis across the U.S. By that time, people in other parts of the world were also starting to notice clusters of similar cases from Japan to Argentina. For many of these patients and the patients from the original outbreak, that paralysis still hasn't gone away, and no one knows if it will.
It likely is a very rare complication of a fairly common infection.
To ferret out the connection between the virus and the strange symptoms, Messikar and his colleagues at the University of Colorado School of Medicine gave enterovirus D68 to mice. In repeated experiments, infected animals became partially paralyzed. The virus traveled to the spinal cord and then killed nerve cells there.
So we have a better understanding that this virus is likely causing an active infection in the spinal cord in the rare cases that it's causing paralysis.
Messikar and his colleagues published their findings in the journal The Lancet Infectious Diseases. But the question remains, how did the virus get to the spinal cord and why doesn't it stay there? That question has some still hesitant to embrace Messikar's finding, including the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Still, Mesikar and his colleagues feel almost certain this is the answer, and they plan to keep an eye out for a resurgence.
If it does come back, if it's in 2018 or if it's in 2022, we want to make sure that we understand it better and that we eventually can prevent it and treat it.
Meanwhile, Lydia Pilarowski is now 9 years old. Her left arm still doesn't work right. Her mom, Sarah, says Lydia can't do cartwheels or swing on the monkey bars very easily.
So a lot of the things that a 9-year-old girl in fourth grade would really love to be able to do with her friends out on the playground, she can't do. But there are so many things that she can do that she just focuses on those.
Like skiing, competitively, even with one weak arm. Someday, Lydia wants to go to the Olympics. For Here and Now, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
Ray Ellen's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau. The leaders of Afghanistan and Pakistan are set to meet tomorrow in Kabul. They're expected to talk about the long-stalled peace process with the Taliban. This comes as the U.S. military accuses Russia of supporting Taliban fighters in Afghanistan. In March, the U.S. commander in Afghanistan, General John Nicholson, told the BBC that Moscow is supplying the militants with weapons.
We share some interests with Russia and Afghanistan, and clearly they're acting to undermine our interests as well. And we are here, in our, especially in our U.S. role, to go after those terrorists who could potentially pose a threat to any country around the world.
Dawood Azami is with the BBC World Service in London. Dawood, exactly what does the general claim the Russians are doing?
Well, General Nicholson is saying that Russia has been supporting the Afghan Taliban, both financially and militarily. This started in December 2016 when General Nicholson accused Russia and Iran of trying to legitimize the Afghan Taliban insurgency. And then after that, he made several statements saying that Russia is supporting the Taliban and at other times saying that they are even giving them weapons. And then some other U.S. military officials also accused Russia of supporting the Taliban with weapons and money. But on the other hand, we have U.S. officials and NATO officials making contradictory statements, saying that we haven't seen any evidence. And this includes James Mattis, the defense secretary and the head of Pentagon Intelligence Agency in the U.S.
Yet the general on the ground says that there is evidence that they are indeed. And in fact, some members of the Afghan military have said that they have seen night vision goggles and other material as well. To what end, though, when the general makes this accusation, what is he claiming the reason is that Russia would be at this point trying to arm the Taliban? To what end?
Well, when we challenge the general about the evidence, he says that he was brought guns, light weapons by Afghan officials, telling him that these are Russian weapons.
That they came from Russia.
Yeah, but then the question is, then the problem is that these weapons are available in Afghanistan anyway and can be bought in the black market in Afghanistan and in the wider region. But we have many Afghan officials on record making the same accusations against Russia.
The Taliban represents a major threat to some Afghans and to Americans on the ground in Afghanistan. What does it represent to Russia?
It's ironic that the Taliban and Russians were enemies in the past. When the Soviet Union was occupying Afghanistan in the 1980s, these people who became later the founding fathers of the Taliban movement were part of the Afghan Mujahideen or resistance fighters who fought against the Soviet Union. And in the factional war in the 1990s, after the withdrawal of Soviet forces from Afghanistan, Russia was supporting the anti-Taliban factions. But it is a dramatic and unexpected shift for Russia to establish links with the Afghan Taliban. And they say that Taliban is a local insurgency. They are fighting within the Afghan borders, and their agenda is local. And this is what the Taliban also say, that our fight is limited to Afghanistan. We haven't carried out any attacks outside the Afghan territory, and that's why Russia gives preference to the Taliban than other groups like Al-Qaeda or Daesh or ISIL. So that's the reason. But for the Taliban, it is important, even if it is not a material support, if it is just a diplomatic support, it is important for the Taliban because it gives them kind of legitimacy, and it enhances their prestige in Afghanistan and in the wider region and internationally. And it shows them as a legitimate resistance group with legitimate concerns.
So there's an argument that if Russia is indeed trying to arm the Taliban, that it's supposedly doing so to try and fight against ISIS. I mean, saying that that's a similar goal as to what the United States have. But there's also some doubt about whether or not it's exaggerating the presence of ISIS in the region. In the larger picture, though, if these accusations that the general is making on the ground in Afghanistan, the U.S. general, are true, What would be the purpose of Russia arming the Taliban beyond the idea of fighting ISIS? I mean, what is General Nicholson afraid of?
Well, General Nicholson is afraid of a couple of things. One, the Taliban were supposed to be heavily dependent on Pakistan. It's where their sanctuaries allegedly are. And it's where their leadership resides, reportedly. But Pakistan, of course, denies this. If Taliban have established links with other regional players, important players like Russia, Iran, so that would make them stronger. That would provide them many alternatives. In that case, it will be very hard for the Afghan government and the U.S.-led NATO forces to defeat them. Because they will be getting resources from several places, several countries, and then they can send some of their leaders to these places to run the or control the insurgency from. So that is the fear. And if the tension between the United States and Russia increases, so that will have a very negative impact on the overall security situation in Afghanistan.
Would it also make it harder for the U.S. to consider completely pulling out of Afghanistan if Russia is found to be arming the Taliban?
If that happens, it will make the resolution of the Afghan conflict even harder, because we will have another actor in the field. So the conflict in Afghanistan is already very complicated. There are so many regional, local, and international actors involved, both state actors and non-state actors. So there's the Afghan Taliban group, the main insurgent group. And until 3 years ago, we didn't have ISIS or ISIL in Afghanistan. Now, that's also a new actor. And until recently, Russia was not so heavily involved in the Afghan affairs. Now it is involved. It is its involvement is increasing now. It's the same with Iran. So all this shows that the conflict and the overall situation is becoming more complicated, and the resolution is becoming harder. But on the other side, if Russia becomes more involved, it might help in a way when it comes to the political settlement, because the Afghan government or the Afghans among themselves cannot resolve the conflict on their own. They need the cooperation of regional powers like Pakistan, Iran, and Russia. So if they are all on board and if all of them support a political settlement, they can use their influence over the Afghan Taliban group to come to the negotiating table. So if the U.S. wants to use these contacts between Russia and Taliban in a different way, they can talk to Russia to use their influence on the Afghan Taliban and bring them to the negotiating table. So that's another way of dealing with this complicated situation.
So there are questions about whether it is happening or not. But Daoud, give us the larger picture here. What are we seeing take shape among Afghan forces, the Taliban, Russia, and the U.S.?
Well, it shows that the geopolitical situation is changing fast. If there is more tension between the U.S. and regional powers like Iran and Russia and Pakistan, so that will make the situation even more difficult and more complicated. And the U.S., I think Moscow wants to put pressure on the U.S. and Afghan government, and it also wants them to take Russia seriously.
Well, put pressure, why? For what purpose?
Because they want to be part of any future arrangement in Afghanistan, and they are not consulted on important issues. For example, last year, Russia tried to find a political solution to the Afghan conflict and invited members and invited representatives of many regional players. They also invited the U.S., and the U.S. refused to attend meetings in Moscow. So Russia on one hand is scared that the insecurity in Afghanistan might expand to its own borders, and on the other hand, it also wants to be part of any future arrangement in Afghanistan, the same way as they are part of the situation. They are part of the conflict in Syria. So they want to be an important player, and they want to be taken seriously, and they want to be consulted on all the important issues, because they see this as their own backyard. They see this an area where they have security interest, and they see this part of their overall security and geostrategic infrastructure. So that's why they are keen to put pressure on the U.S. to listen to them and to at least involve them in key decision-making processes.
Daoud Azami is with the BBC World Service, speaking to us from London. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Lisa.
U.S. wine producers are among those likely to be affected by the growing tension with China over trade. China says it'll respond to U.S. tariffs with additional tariffs on American goods, among them a 15% tax on U.S. wine imports to the country. Those tariffs may ultimately get scrapped if the two countries can work out their differences, but at least one vineyard in California is already feeling the effects. Chinese importers have told Wente Family Estates to put a shipment of 5,000 cases of wine on hold. Charisse Jones of USA Today has been looking into this and joins us now. Hi, Charisse.
Hi.
So China already puts a 14% tariff on U.S. wines that it imports. So this would add another 15%. If it does, it sounds pretty onerous.
Yeah, it could be really significant. I mean, it could basically price out U.S. wines in the China market, and that's one of the fastest growing wine markets in the world. So other countries can kind of fill that space. You know, their bottles will be cheaper, and it could deprive a major industry in this country of a prime destination. So it could really do some damage.
Well, tariffs aren't in effect just yet. There is a chance, of course, that one or both sides will back down or they'll reach some kind of an agreement. But we mentioned this one vineyard that's already feeling the strain because of the threat of the tariffs alone. What are the other direct and indirect effects on the industry?
You know, it's just a lot of uncertainty, right? I mean, there were 5,000 cases of this wine that were ready to go from Wente to China. And the importers there basically said, we don't want it right now because they don't know what's going to happen. If the tariff really does come to pass, the bottles might be so expensive that they don't sell. And another concern is that this is going to hurt the reputation of American products with the Chinese consumer. You know, out of a sense of loyalty to the government, they may not want U.S. goods. So it just kind of puts the entire industry in limbo.
And you said the U.S. or that China is a growing market for wine. How about for American wine?
it's exploding there. Sales have gone up 450% over the last decade. It's become the fifth biggest importer of U.S. wines. Consumption of imported wine has gone up 2.5 times. So you just got this incredibly large population that, you know, now has disposable income. And just like they want the watch or the smartphone or the upgraded car to show that they're successful, a nice bottle of Chardonnay from California also makes them feel really good. And so it's just it's a market that's really got a lot of possibility.
There are a lot of wine-growing regions in the world, of course. If China buys less wine from California or from the U.S. in general, can it just get it from elsewhere?
Absolutely. And that's what's worrying wine growers here. You mean, you've got Chile, Australia, New Zealand, the country of Georgia, and they also don't have as many barriers. I mean, they've got a lot of free trade agreements with China. Australia's going to have a free trade agreement with it as of next year, so there won't be any tariff on the wine. So they already have that advantage. And wine growers are really worried here that if they lose their space in the market, it's going to be hard to get it back.
It would be hard to get it back because they couldn't find other markets for California or American wines?
Well, you know, they've already got a big presence in the EU and in Canada. Those markets are kind of saturated. And we just have to remember there are 1 billion people in China who are just discovering their love of wine. And so that's not a market you want to displace. And it's hard to replicate.
Thank you. Cherise Jones of USA Today. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Today, Facebook removed ads and pages from a Russian group indicted for interfering in the 2016 U.S. election. The Kremlin denounced the move as censorship. Facebook has been under pressure to change recently after it was revealed that the political firm Cambridge Analytica harvested data on tens of millions of Americans. And yesterday, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg further apologized for his role in that scandal. He's set to testify before Congress next week. Let's bring in Zeynep Tufekci. She's a professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, in the School of Information and Library Science. And she recently wrote a New York Times op-ed about the dangers of Facebook's business model. Hi, Zeynep.
Hi.
My first question to you is, are you a Facebook user?
Of course I am.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. I find it very useful. I have far-flung family there on Facebook. I've always written about the fact that we're there because we've invested so much of our relationships and interactions there that we kind of find ourselves going back.
So you find it useful just like 2 billion other people around the world also do. But what did you think when you heard about the Cambridge Analytica story? Because you also have pointed criticisms about the platform.
Correct. And it has a record of being very data hungry in that it scoops up an enormous amount of user data, not just what you do on the site, it even purchases data about you and merges it with its own data.
Really?
Yeah. And I have to say, unfortunately, I wasn't surprised as much by the current scandal because what happened was until 2015, Facebook allowed these kinds of apps to harvest not just your data on Facebook, but your friends' data. So even if you'd never downloaded this app or any other app, some random Facebook friend of yours did, they got your data too. So the current scandal is focused on the fact that one of those apps was fronted by an academic who apparently passed the data to Cambridge Analytica, which then became Donald Trump's firm. But there were thousands and thousands of apps scooping up people's data. I'd be shocked if there aren't a lot more cases of this.
Right. And that's the fallout from all of this. We are now having all sorts of conversations and learning about the types of information that this company has on us. I was speaking with our tech reporter this week about how to change your privacy settings on Facebook. And I learned how you can go into your account and you can see how much Facebook can target the ads that it shows you. It knows a lot about you.
And it doesn't show you everything. Like when you go there, you're not getting a full picture of all the algorithmic targeting they're doing. You know, they're just giving you, well, we have these categories for you, but there's a lot more going on under that engine.
And you even write about something called shadow profiles of non-users. What's that?
Correct. Even if you've never been on Facebook, what happens is, for example, on Android phones, right? If you downloaded the Facebook app or the Messenger app, it turns out Facebook's been uploading to its own servers and keeping a copy of your text messages, which means even if you've never been on it and you were texting with somebody who's on Facebook or who uses the app or who uploaded their contact list, which is a very common way people connect with Facebook, it means that it kind of knows who your friends are. It can place you in a network. And Facebook keeps these shadow profiles of its non-users so that it can identify and profile and sometimes even target them. It's right. Kind of hard to exaggerate what a data-hungry company this is.
So it sounds like you're implying that no matter what you do, you can even go into the system and you can turn off all the buttons that give all this private information
helps,
about yourself.
There's really no escape completely.
You can't put the genie back into the bottle, it sounds
no,
like you're saying.
No.
So let me play devil's advocate then and ask, what's the harm in that?
Well, the harm in that is what you're doing is you have this asymmetric information where there's a couple of companies that know this enormous amount of information about you. And you'd have no clue that you were being manipulated and sort of attacked where you are weakest. And this isn't just politics, right? This is, for example, advertisers have figured out that women are more likely to purchase makeup when they feel fat, ugly, depressed, or lonely. Well, is this really the best way to market to people? And your Facebook profile would give that away. In
right.
Australia,
you
it was reported.
You could be posting something that says you're feeling bad about yourself or you're just
and
feeling
the
blue
thing
and
is,
all of a sudden you get a makeup advertisement.
It doesn't even work that way, right? If it worked that way, you would at least say, I'm not going to post this. These things can be inferred. In Australia, Facebook executives were allegedly telling advertisers they can figure out when teens feel insecure. There's a lot of ways in which being targeted this way is not compatible with a healthy public sphere, commercially or politically.
So when Facebook frames itself as this egalitarian community, and Mark Zuckerberg argues that without advertising, Facebook couldn't cater to people or countries where they may not have the same ability to pay for the service, you think what?
So lots of things I think about that. For one thing, like a couple years ago, I wrote about this. I said, let me pay for Facebook. So maybe for a couple of dollars a month, we could have the services that Facebook provides. So you could have that. That's the first thing. You could have advertising that's not targeted like this. You know, if I search for something and if I want to go look for, climbing equipment or diving equipment, by all means, you know, send me some information that way.
Because it's useful.
Let me opt into what I find useful rather than opaquely target me without me knowing. The third world people that can't necessarily afford it, it's something I'm sensitive to because I have friends and family in lots of places. And I want to say WhatsApp, which was a competitor to Facebook.
Now
and Facebook
owned by
bought
the company.
For $20 billion. That kind of money could go into some level of cross-subsidy where people in rich countries get to pay a little bit so that we're no longer manipulated this way. And we subsidize poorer places a little bit. That's totally workable.
Now, you've come up with some ideas to maybe help fix the problem, but Facebook says, hey, it could be open to regulation. I mean, do you think that there is a regulation that would work, that would make an impact?
I would think that making data retention completely opt-in so that you have to be asked about whether or not you want your data to be retained and regulating that data has to be erased. There are all these things that if they were done, not only would they work, right now Silicon Valley is technologically fairly uninnovative. It's stuck in a rut because it's got all this data. It's kind of like it's – think of it this way. You've got this oil economy and oil is really cheap. you're not going to develop green technologies. There's a lot of new innovative things that I hear about, but who's going to invest in them while you can, you know, scoop up people's data this way? We need to control the emissions so that green technologies are invested in, including for Facebook. They'll be fine. They will do things that are slightly more complicated, perhaps. They will still probably be fabulously wealthy. It's just they won't be able to print money this easily, yeah, just grabbing everyone's data.
Zeynep, here we are talking in 2018. But take this tale and project it forward 50 years, 100 years. What is the most dystopian future you can imagine all of this taking if there are no changes to the way that we live our lives on the internet?
So the dystopian version of this is that the data on us becomes a tool of social control that operates through soft power. We are constantly nudged and manipulated and controlled. And you already see some versions of this in China. But here's the thing. The reason I talk about all of this, the reason I've been talking about all of this for so long, is that this is very young. When we started, say, at the stage of, say, cars, we didn't have seatbelts. They didn't have emission controls. They didn't have airbags. And the car industry had to be dragged into implementing better safety, kicking and screaming. Well, you know what? It turned out to be a good thing for the companies, too. The thing I want to emphasize is rather than focus on the dystopia, what people need to understand is there's nothing inevitable about the way the data retention and surveillance and digital technology works at the moment. Mm. If we change this, it'll be good for innovation, it'll be good for technology, it'll be good for business models, and it'll be good for us. So let's do that rather than, you know, focus on the spectacle side of things. It's so very early.
That's Zeynep Tufekci. She's a professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and author of Twitter and Tear Gas, The Power and Fragility of Networked Protest. Thanks for sharing your insights with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
When in Hawaii, if you really want to sample authentic Hawaiian culture, you need to go to the annual Merry Monarch Festival. It's the world's most prestigious hula competition, and it gets underway this weekend on the Big Island. And this year, a group from Washington State is competing, a first from the state in the festival's 55-year history. It's a big deal for the participants and for the thousands of native Hawaiians who live on the mainland. Marcy Silman from member station KUOW in Seattle has more.
If you're not from Hawaii, chances are you learned about hula from TV, movies, and songs like this. The Hawaiian war chant became a huge hit after it was featured in the 1942 film Ship Ahoy, starring Eleanor Powell. Thing is, as you can hear, this song isn't really a war chant. Hawaii native Kamaile Hamada says the original song, written in the 1800s by a Hawaiian prince, was actually about a clandestine meeting between two lovers.
Hollywood has videotaped the Hawaiian war chant and with skirts and feathered uli uli and all that kind of stuff. It's something upbeat and all that kind of stuff, right? But in actuality, it's not a war chant. It is a love-making song, yeah.
You won't hear anything like it when Hamada's hula group gets together. Real Hula is a repository of Hawaiian indigenous culture, oral history, and tradition. And that's what Hamada teaches the students at his halau, or school, south of Seattle. He's a kumu hula, literally a source of hula knowledge. Hamada's been trying to take his group to the Merry Monarch Festival in Hawaii for more than a decade.
Everybody that's grown up in Hawaii, in hula, that Marimonarch stage is a goal. And once you get onto that stage, then you are part of the who's who in hula.
This is the Olympics of hula competitions.
That's Tanya Camacho Jose. Her mother, Sweetie Camacho, led this group with Hamada before she passed away in 2009.
My grandma, my mom's mom, she participated in the very first Mary Monarch. So for me, this is beyond a dream. I mean, I never thought at all possible this would happen for us. I mean, you know, every hula person wants to be on that stage.
The group's been rehearsing 6 days a week to get ready. They'll perform two different types of hula. The first, called kahiko, goes back centuries before white explorers landed in the Hawaiian Islands. The dancers hold slim wooden sticks they beat together to the rhythm of their chant. Ancient hulas like this retell Hawaiian history and legend, according to Ivalani Christian. She's a kumuhula at another halau in Washington State. Christian has studied traditional Hawaiian culture for more than 40 years.
I was groomed at a very early age in the culture by my tutuwahine, my grandmother, and she endowed upon me the responsibility to preserve and perpetuate the culture.
Christian says her most important duty is to transmit Hawaii's oral history to the next generation through hula.
It's not just teaching a dance. It's going to be perpetuated, right, and preserved in the form that it needs to be.
Like many indigenous traditions, hula was suppressed by Western colonizers. Practitioners went underground. Hula didn't resurface until the late 19th century. That's when Hawaii's last king, David Kalakaua, included it at his coronation celebration. Kalakaua was known as the Merry Monarch. He's the namesake of today's prestigious hula festival. Kamaile Hamada has done all he can to prep his group for the festival. Win or lose, this is the culmination of a dream he shared with his late partner, Sweetie Camacho. As soon as he found out they were in, he went to her grave.
As soon as I hung up the phone, then I went to visit Sweetie at her, where she's at. And of course, cry and all that kind of stuff for the goal is finally going to come true, right?
Kamaile Hamada and his halau members compete against 24 hula groups this weekend at the Merry Monarch Festival in Hilo, Hawaii. For Here and Now, I'm Marcy Silman in Seattle.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.